Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. If there's one place on Earth where scientific research and wild natural beauty coincide at epic scales, it has to be Antarctica. And when we think of that icy place on our planet, the image of penguins surely comes to mind. In her new book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, a story of penguins, people, and place in Antarctica, conservation biologist and seabird expert Louise K. Blight gives us a vivid inside account of what it's like to do research there. Blight spent an entire summer research season based on Ross Island in the early 2000s studying a large colony of Adelie penguins. It's a story of coping with the loss of her sister and how the journey inside her mind and spirit coincided with an amazing time living and working in the austere beauty of Antarctica, all while doing valuable scientific research on the iconic bird species. Louise K. Blight is an adjunct professor at the University of Victoria School of Environmental Studies. She's authored more than 50 scientific publications and serves as the co-chair of the Bird Specialist Subcommittee of the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada. She lives on the Salish Sea coast on Salt Spring Island in British Columbia and joins us from there now. Louise K. Blight, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me here.
First off, I'd like to know, when exactly did your trip to Antarctica take place?
Well, I've done a number of trips to Antarctica.
But the one you chronicle in this book.
Yeah, the one that I write about in Where the Earth Meets the Sky is in the 2003-2004 austral summer.
And tell us about your previous experiences. What was it that drew you to Antarctica the first time and then subsequently?
For some reason, I had always wanted to go to Antarctica since before I started working as a seabird biologist. So I first started to realize that I could work on seabirds during the very last course of my undergraduate degree at the University of Victoria. And I needed one more course to graduate. And I signed up for a field course at Banfield Marine Station, which is a field station that is run by all the Western universities in Canada. And it was a course on the biology of marine birds. And you go and live at the field station for most of the summer for these field courses. And I suddenly realized, wow, I can, you know, specialize in both the ocean, which I love. You know, I grew up on the west coast of Canada, so love the ocean, grew up with boats and so on. And I'd always loved birds. And so I realized, wow, marine birds, I can work on this. And so for people that are working on marine birds, the Antarctic is a special place because of, you know, the sheer numbers of penguins and petrels and so on. So I thought I would try to go there. And at that, the first time I went, I'd actually worked on boats quite a bit. And I decided to apply to a cruise ship company that was going from Canada to the Antarctic because I had a lot of small boat handling experience. And I knew that they'd need to drive Zodiacs from ship to shore to land passengers at the various places they'd visit. And I also knew that I could work as a naturalist. So I applied for one of those jobs and got it. And that was kind of my first introduction to being in Antarctica.
Can you remember, you know, that first impression of Antarctica when you first actually got to be there physically and experience it for yourself?
I absolutely can. The expedition leader on this first trip that we were working on had worked in Antarctica before as well. He was experienced there as a tour guide, I guess. He eventually ended up doing some monitoring programs there, but he'd worked in Antarctica quite a lot. And so he was talking to the passengers and to us expedition crew staff, as we were called, about what it would be like to get there. And he was saying, you know, it's going to be one morning you'll get up when you're in the Drake Passage, and it's going to be like someone's opened the door to a refrigerator. And that was absolutely what it was like when we crossed the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. The water is suddenly around 0 degrees. The bird fauna changes, the marine birds that you see around the ship. It's often foggy. There are icebergs in the distance. So, you know, around that time, you start to see the first iceberg. And then, of course, everyone's up on the bridge of the ship looking avidly for the first penguin. and imagining that we're seeing penguins on the icebergs in the distance. We didn't actually see our first penguins until we got to Deception Island, which is a volcanic island in the South Shetlands. But yes, I remember vividly the first time that we saw land with penguins on it.
And then tell us about what led to you deciding to do this season of field study that you got to do with the penguins.
Yeah, like I was saying, I've worked on marine birds for a long time. At that point, I was getting into doing it. And I'd worked remotely at a number of sites in Canada and worked on ships doing marine bird work at that point, other than working in Antarctica as a Zodiac driver and naturalist and visiting data collector. And I'd done my master's at that point working on rhinoceros auklets at a seabird colony, very remote seabird colony off the west coast of Canada. And so I knew what it was like to work really remotely and also what it was like to work in Antarctica. So I just decided that I would apply for this job posting that I'd heard about, and I was lucky enough to get it. And that's the season that I write about in the book, is working as a field assistant in that one particular summer.
And as part of the backdrop of this book is the loss of your sister and what you experienced with that. And as somebody who's gone through grief and a similar experience to what you went through, not definitely not the same. They're never the same.
No.
Understanding what that was like for you. I found that to be a very powerful aspect of the book and how your experiences down there kind of reflected on your feelings of that. So how long after the loss of your sister was it that you went to the field study season?
The trip that I write about was about 4 years after my sister died. And I think, you know, when I started writing the book, my sister had been in my mind while I was working there that particular season and appeared in my journals a couple of times. But it was when I was writing the book itself that I realized that she was kind of a constant
presence.
Thoughts, or yes, a presence. Mm-hmm. She and my dad, actually, who had died a while before that. And so, yeah, writing the book, like I said, made me realize that more. And I also realized how, well, it wasn't like it was a revelation writing the book. I'd become very stuck in my grief, I think.
It's easy to do.
Yeah. She was in her mid-30s when she died and had two young children. And, you know, there's nothing good you can say about someone's death when they're that young, when they die. You know, if someone's lived a full life, you can say, well, they lived a full life. But
yes,
you can't say that about someone dying young. And so it was, I found it hard to grieve that death because it was a very hard loss. And then the distractions of society and the sort of strictures consciously or unconsciously placed by us on our society to not display grief all made that quite hard. And so, you know, I think being in a place where I was just working day after day after day, just completely involved in the work we were doing with the animals, but also surrounded by this incredibly beautiful nature and nothing else, no distractions.
It strips all of that stuff away.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I wouldn't say that it completed my grieving process or anything, but it did help a lot of things move through.
Yeah, I felt like it gave you access to it in a profound way, in a very profound way. Well, let's talk about the penguins, because they're front and center in this story. Tell us about these type of penguins, Adelaide penguins. They were fascinating. And the place that you were at, Cape Royds. Tell us about these penguins and what makes them unique.
Yeah, Adelie penguins. They and emperor penguins are the most southerly nesting penguins in the world. So emperor penguins are the very big penguins that people know about from various movies and so on. They're the ones that incubate their eggs. The males incubate them on their feet. They have these big, fluffy, gray, cute chicks. And then the Adelie penguins are the ones that we studied that nest at similar latitudes. And Adelies are like your basic black and white penguins. So they're just white belly, black head and face and back. And they're the penguins that are kind of the quintessential penguin that the world first heard about from the Antarctic explorers. So There are millions of them in the Ross Sea, which is where people like Scott and Shackleton were doing their journeys of exploration. And so images of these penguins made it back to the West pretty early on. So people have known about them for a long time in popular culture as well as in science. And in fact, they're one of the best studied bird species in the world. And that's because of things like my mentor, David Ainley, who I was working with there on that project, has a very long-term study, been going on for about 40 years at the same place that I write about in the book on Ross Island, at Cape Royds and other penguin colonies on Ross Island. And they were studied by the person that David did his PhD with before him as well. And then Ross Island, the place where the study took place and is still taking place in different iterations now. Ross Island is the location of McMurdo Station, so the U.S. National Science Foundation's biggest Antarctic station. It's also the location of Scott Base, which is the New Zealand Antarctic station. And it's the location from which Scott went to the pole, Shackleton attempted to go to the pole, and the location of the three Adélie penguin colonies that are the main focus of this ongoing research. So I was mostly based at Cape Royds, the smallest colony of the three, where there's sort of 2,500 to 3,000 pairs of Adélie penguins. And then Cape Crozier is the biggest colony, and there are hundreds of thousands of pairs at that site.
Describe Cape Royds for us, because you do it brilliantly in the book. It's just such a magnificent landscape where you're looking out over the sea and the ice and the mountains. Just describe it for us a little bit.
So Cape Royds is the westernmost cape of Ross Island. It's a bit to the north of McMurdo Station and Scott Base. And it's just all of Ross Island is volcanic. Its main volcanic cone is Mount Erebus, which is an active volcano. And so the landscape there is very black. And so people think of Antarctica and, of course, think of snow and ice. And there's, of course, a huge amount of ice there locked up in glaciers. But the landscape itself tends to be fairly snow-free because it's so windy. Cape Royds is an extremely windy place, as I also describe in the book, right about a hurricane that we went through. And various storms. But it's because of that wind that the land is swept free of the snow that falls. And it's because of that wind blowing away the snow and also the ice in the surrounding waters that the Adélies are nesting there. So it's kind of this black volcanic landscape with striations of a bit of snow and ice. And then a lot of penguins on the volcanic rocky protuberances that come out of the ground and are completely snow and ice and moisture free so that birds can nest there.
And one of the really fascinating things to me, and kind of gross but cool, was that these penguin colonies, the one that you studied, it's all covered in, you know, layer after layer of guano and dead penguins. Describe, you know, kind of what a strange place it is.
That's right. So, you know, when we look out the window at our garden or a field or something here, there are plants growing on it and they're growing in the soil that's accumulated over, you know, however many millennia from decayed vegetation matter and dead worms and invertebrates churning up the soil and so on and so forth. There's virtually no vegetation at Cape Royds. There are, you know, there's lichen on rocks. There are a few areas of terrestrial algae and moss. But it's mostly this bare rock that I just described poking up out of what we call ornithogenic soil, which literally means that it's soil that's come from birds or been generated by birds. And so it's, in some places, it can be really deep, you know, like a meter or two thick. But essentially, it's just the soil that's formed from the penguin colony, which is the main input of organic matter, virtually the only input. And so you've got, you know, obviously penguin guano, You've got birds coming in regurgitating krill and fish for their chicks. So anything that gets dropped and doesn't get picked up again. And then the other birds there, like the skuas, are doing similar things. But it's mostly from the effect of these thousands of penguins at a given colony that are building up or creating soil to be built up over time. And of course, part of what's in that soil are dead penguins. So mostly dead eggs and dead chicks that didn't make it out of a given year that form part of that soil layer as well. And people have studied that as well. Steve Emsley is one of the people that's looked at that and sort of drilled down through the soil and looked at how old some of these penguin colonies are in the Ross Sea region.
Do we have any idea like what an age for them is?
If I remember correctly, Cape Royds is about 1,000 years old, and then some of the ones around the Ross Sea are older than that.
Wow, it's a little penguin civilization that's lasted thousands of years.
Yeah, yes,
that's amazing.
As ice recedes, ice has receded there a bit, and as areas become ice-free, then they get colonized by penguins and other birds.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Canadian seabird conservation biologist Louise K. Blight, author of the new book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, a story of penguins, people, and place in Antarctica. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our interview with Canadian conservation biologist Louise K. Blight as we discuss her memoir about a field season studying penguins in Antarctica. The book is titled Where the Earth Meets the Sky, and it vividly recalls the hardships and beauty she experienced while doing science at a remote field station on Ross Island. Well, let's talk about Antarctica in general, because one of the neat things about your book is you talk about like these three eras of Antarctica, the original explorers, and you've mentioned Scott and Shackleton, and that, you know, heroic age of exploration, which was, you know, a lot of tragedies involved there and hardships. It sounded like you did quite a bit of reading about that and studying about, you know, those who came before you, and Shackleton's cabin is right there where you were staying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shackleton's cabin kind of ended up being an important part of the story and our time there. And, you know, it's one of the reasons that I wanted to keep journals is to kind of capture the immediacy of experiences as they happened. I mean, you know how it is. You go somewhere new and everything is wonderful and novel and interesting. And after a month, you can't remember what's interesting anymore. You just kind of take it for granted. So one of the things that was, of course, novel and interesting was walking past Shackleton's Nimrod expedition hut every day on the way to the colony and back again to our research camp.
And for our listeners, how old is that?
It's about 100 years old. It was built in the late 1900s, so just under 100 years
from the time you were there.
From the time that I wrote the book, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
kind of in that environment. It's so dry and desiccated and cold there. It's pretty well preserved.
Mm-hmm. And another set of events I write about in the book is the fact that the New Zealand Antarctic Heritage Trust was there surveying the hut the season that I was working there in preparation for doing subsequent restoration work of it. So everything in the hut, you know, it was locked. We couldn't access it that often, but we could occasionally go in there with visiting groups. And, you know, everything was just there as it was left. So crates of supplies and tins stacked on the shelves and old boots in the corners and so on. And, you know, the labels were, of course, peeling off the tins and the boots were looking a bit desiccated, but the hut itself, you know, it's like a well-preserved human being. You wouldn't have said it was 100 years old.
Yeah, one of the really cool things for me reading about that aspect of the book was, especially towards the end of your book, where you felt like the presence of Shackleton, where you almost felt like you could, you know, turn around and there he would be, you know, laughing at a joke from his friends, and that, you know, his presence was, you know, just kind of there.
Mm-hmm. That's part of the experience of the incredible isolation there, not just the isolation of Antarctica, where there were just a few thousand people on an entire continent at any given time, but the isolation of being at Cape Royds, living at our field site with just one other person, with the head researcher in the program, David.
Yeah, David, talk a bit about your camp, because I love the way you portrayed it. I felt like one of the neat things about this book is I felt like I was there with you every day. Tell us about what it's like to actually live at a place like that for months on end, because it's not easy. It's definitely not your basic camping trip.
Certainly not your basic camping trip. It's living in the field to work there for, you know, 2.5 months. The trip was about 3 months overall. So 2.5 months at this remote field site. I mean, to me, I mentioned that I did my master's at a remote research site, a remote seabird colony in British Columbia. And I worked remotely in other places studying seabirds. And the research hut at Cape Royds actually felt like a bit of a luxury to me. And that's because, you know, it's set up through the U.S. Antarctic Program. It's well-resourced, but also it's set up for people to live at and work at for 2 or 3 months. And so we had a canvas-sided hut called a rack tent. It's sort of like a canvas Quonset hut with section flooring, wood ribs, yellow canvas in color, so that we always had the sunlight shining through the walls, which gave it this beautiful kind of yellow color in the interior, and then plexiglass or plastic clear panels in the roof. So very well-lit. Single room, small, Spartan, but we had everything we needed there. We had big propane cylinders, so we had a propane heater. We cooked on a propane stove. We had tons of food supplies that were all, you know, similarly to Shackleton's hut down the hill, which also made us feel close to Shackleton in both space and time. We had all our supplies lined up on shelves around the walls of the hut, just like down at his hut. And then I slept in a tent, a mountaineering tent, that was right outside the research hut. And that was my little space where I, you know, kept my bedroll and books and things like that.
And you also, because it is Antarctica and we're trying our best to preserve it, you have to get rid of all of your waste. Could you just talk a bit about, you know, that's a lot of work.
All human waste, all cooking waste, all gets shipped back off the continent. In early days of those stations being there, McMurdo Station being there, not the research site that I was at Cape Royds, but the big station at McMurdo, waste was just put out to the sea ice and left to drift off into McMurdo Sound and sink at some point. Obviously, that's not done anymore. And so all waste is shipped off the continent. And so in terms of facilitating that, someone somewhere came up with the idea, presumably for good reasons, that solid waste and liquid waste needs to be separated. And so urine is, you know, you have a pee pot, and then urine gets decanted into a 50-gallon drum every few days. And then at the end of the season, that drum gets slung out on a helicopter and eventually shipped off the continent.
Yeah, and also another interesting aspect of this place is in the past was the International Geophysical Year, mm-hmm. which, you know, also looms large in your story. And it kind of brings about the modern era of science coming to Antarctica. Could you, you know, maybe talk a bit about the echoes of IGY you experienced while you were there?
Yeah, IGY, everyone who works in Antarctica knows about it, because even though it happened in 57 and 58, it was foundational to kind of the modern era of doing science in Antarctica. So it was, as you said, there was the heroic era of Antarctic exploration, which was in the early part of the the 20th century. And then in the middle of the century, the IGY was what sort of set off the next wave of science there, as it did for other things elsewhere in the world. So, for example, McMurdo Station at Amundsen Scott Station at the South Pole was built then. So the groundwork really for the kind of work that's being, that continues to be done today was the IGY was pivotal to that, being able to continue to happen.
Well, let's talk about the science that you did. Well, I found it really interesting to learn about, you know, what are you trying to accomplish while you're there with these penguins? And a lot of it is just really, you know, it's hard work. Can you talk about, you know, some of the stuff you actually had to do to study the penguins?
Yeah, you're right. It is hard work. I mean, it's fun work. It's enjoyable if you're a seabird biologist or seabird scientist. Usually a daily routine of collecting data on your study birds and their study nests, for example, and then collecting environmental data of some sort as well. So, for example, I would get up in the morning there and go to a focal set of study nests that we were working with, our monitoring nests, and see if there were any new eggs, any new pairs had come in, any chicks had hatched, and so on. And then all those data are recorded in our field notebooks using pencil and notebook, which is still the case today, and it partly because people just like doing that, and partly, you know, it's security against losing a tablet or something like that, or a tablet crashing or not working well in weather. But anyway, recording your daily data, a big part of the study in general is looking at movement of penguins among the colonies that I described on Ross Island. So the phase of the study when I worked there was called something like the geographic structuring of a daily penguin colonies. And so in previous years, adults had been banded. We were continuing to band adults, but mostly we were banding chicks at the end of the season. And then a big part of what we were all doing each day was walking around and looking for banded penguins. And so what that was doing was giving us data on basically, you know, who'd survived and who was returning to where. And so the sort of truism in seabird biology is that seabirds are very phylopatric. So they go back to the place where they were hatched, where they were born, and they, you know, in turn have their own, lay their own eggs, have their own chicks there, and so on and so forth. But it turns out that the reality, at least in some places, at least for a daily penguins, in a time of environmental stress, because as you'll know from the book, it was a period of time, not just one season, several seasons, when the entire Ross Sea was affected by the fact that the world's biggest iceberg was blocking ice movement in the Ross Sea. And so this was having a big effect on penguins being able to access the colonies, basically. So with Cape Royds being the most affected, because all the sea ice that would normally be flushed out in the spring by wind and so on was being held in by this massive iceberg that was the size of Prince Edward Island. And so we were looking at movement among colonies just to see how the presence of the iceberg was changing that phylopatry of the penguins at the colonies there.
And at times you are banding the penguins and physically working with them. And there were some descriptions you had there of, you know, kind of getting beat up at times by the penguins.
Yeah, you know, like a lot of colonial seabirds on seabird colony islands, they nest on islands to avoid terrestrial predators. And so they have not evolved, or they have lost any evolved fear of terrestrial predators other than other birds, you know, things coming from the sky. But they're completely not bothered by people wandering around. I shouldn't say not bothered at all, but you know, we take steps not to disturb them, but they're fairly unfazed by people being in the colony and are much more likely, well, mostly to ignore you. But as the younger birds come in later in the breeding season, the ones that are coming in and prospecting for future years, they're usually not on a nest, and they can be quite aggressive in their big groups of juvenile penguins and are quite likely to attack you because they're, you know, you're in their way or something.
Sure. Yeah, you're in their space.
Yeah. And attacking by them, you know, it's something that's been written about since the days of James Murray, who was Shackleton's biologist, of, you know, penguins grabbing onto the bottom of your coat and pummeling at your legs with their flippers, or which is something that happened to me, or just running up to you and butting you in the leg and things like that. They can be quite territorial and aggressive.
Yeah. And another interesting thing to me about the penguins was their interactions with the skua, those birds. Can you describe those birds? And, you know, they live together, but they definitely are competing.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes competing, or sometimes having predator-prey interactions. So there are a few species of skuas in the world, S-K-U-A. And skuas are a gull relative, and they basically look like at least the ones in the Antarctic look like a large, fierce brown gull. And one of the things that they feed on, they aren't particularly numerous. You know, there are a few dozen pairs at Cape Royds compared to thousands of penguins. But one of the things they feed on are penguins. And so that's presumably one of the reasons for them being close to the penguin colonies, although there are certainly skuas that exist in places where there aren't penguin colonies. But there are usually, you know, on a given day at Cape Royds, I'd be walking around and there would be a few pairs of skuas on the edge of the colony, always on the lookout for an unguarded penguin egg or an unguarded penguin chick that they could fly in and nab and make off and either eat themselves or feed to their chicks. So that's is another main denizen of Cape Royds, was the South Polar skua population.
There was one penguin story in particular, which I found very moving and fascinating. You had an observation of a penguin, a female, that was very badly wounded, and you were pretty convinced that this penguin was not going to survive very long. And your colleague, David, says, prepare to be amazed. Tell us a bit about that bird.
Yes, penguin 1091. So I remember I was doing one of my rounds of the colony one afternoon. You know, as I said, we spend a lot of time walking around the colony looking for banded birds. So I would have been doing that. And then I saw a penguin that was down by the entrance to the colony from the sea. There were a couple of places where all the penguins came ashore. It was a shallow, shelving, sloped seafloor and a narrow spot in the entrance to the colony that they used. And there was a penguin lying on the ground there, completely covered in blood and barely able to move. And so I went and looked at it to see what was wrong, just assuming that it had been attacked by a leopard seal. So leopard seal is another penguin predator, and there are one or two individuals usually patrolling the edge of the colony in the ocean at Cape Royds and various other penguin colonies, of course. Anyway, I quickly figured that that's what had happened to this particular penguin. And then I realized that she was one of the penguins from the reference colony, the monitoring colony that I was responsible for monitoring. So she was banded with band 1091. That was what we called her. And as I said, when I first saw her, she was barely able to move. She was kind of trying to drag herself up to the reference colony where her mate was waiting for her, sitting on their eggs. And I just thought that she was going to die. And then I mentioned it to David over a meal, and that's when he said, prepare to be amazed. And I kind of thought, well, you haven't seen this bird. She's mortally wounded. But indeed, I was amazed. And she not only made it back to her nest, but, you know, shows up several other times as she comes and goes to the colony and back to the ocean again.
Yeah, and not to make light of it, but that is one tough bird.
They are very tough birds. Yep.
Yes. They live in such a harsh place. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Canadian wildlife biologist Louise K. Blight. She's the author of the new book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, a story of penguins, people, and place in Antarctica. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with Canadian conservation biologist Louise K. Blight. She's an adjunct professor at the University of Victoria School of Environmental Studies and the author of the new book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, a story of penguins, people, and place in Antarctica, where she recounts her season of doing field research on Adélie penguins on Ross Island. One of the things that fascinated me was just how you have to deal with the weather while you're there because it's so extreme. And you described the light on the tent. And for our listeners, you have to realize that it never gets dark there in the Antarctic summer. You know, it's light all the time. And it was interesting that just your accounts of, you know, being in your tent and the wind whipping and the extreme cold and, you know, it's light outside. And boy, it can really wreak havoc with your sleep cycle with all of that going on.
Yeah, that's right. And so we first got to Ross Island in November, and the sun was setting when we first got there, but it would just dip down below the horizon for an hour or two. And then shortly after that, the sun stopped setting, which of course is summer in the polar latitudes. And so, yes, it was, I mean, it wasn't necessarily sunny because we had a lot of bad weather, but it was certainly broad daylight for 24 hours a day. And anyone who's spent any time at higher latitudes, like in the Canadian Arctic or something, will be familiar with the massive burst of energy that you get from being around 24 hours of daylight, which is, it's pretty cool, but it also, as you said, it does wreak havoc with your sleep cycles. And it's called physiological free run, and it's something that's been studied by human physiologists and so on. But for some people, I mean, it never seemed to affect my colleague, David, who, like I said, been working in the Antarctic for decades, but for me, as for many people, you know, you just end up going to bed later and later at night and getting up later and later in the morning. And unless you check it, you would just eventually end up going to bed at 6 a.m. and getting up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and just sort of freewheeling your day through the whole season.
Yeah, which would mess up your work cycle and schedule and everything like that. So
yeah, if everyone else is doing the same thing, which yeah. They seem to do more with the team at Cape Crozier. It's fine, but it does make it's one of the challenges to maintaining crew cohesion and an organized camp life. That's for sure.
Yeah, one of the also interesting aspects was when you would go from your encampment there and just the isolation of you and David and the occasional visitors which would come, and that was always interesting. But you would also go to McMurdo, MacTown as they call it. And it was interesting to just the juxtaposition between you being out in that, you know, wilderness and the quiet and, well, the noise of the wind and the penguins and things like that. And then all of a sudden, bam, you're back in this world of people. And that was really interesting to me to see those shifts and juxtapositions in your lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was certainly fun to go into town and take a break, go to town, as we called it, although it was never much of a break because there was always so much to do. And as a sidebar, I found these trips to town or the retelling of the trips to town kind of an interesting example of memory. So I'd written the book manuscript, which I, as I mentioned, I took from my journals that I kept while I was there. So to my mind, they were accurate, and I actually sent the manuscript to David to get his input, particularly on the penguin science of it. And one of his comments was, well, I guess you took some license because we sure didn't go into town that often. which I said, I found very funny. And also, as I said, interesting about memory, because and the role memory plays in writing a book like this, because, again, to my mind, it's accurate because it's taken from my journals that I wrote at the time. Someone else was there doesn't remember things in the same way at all. I find that very interesting.
Yeah. And when you're in town around people, it sounds like kind of a lot of fun, you've met a lot of interesting people and made lots of interesting friends. And there's kind of an interesting camaraderie there between folks that are together.
A bit of a whiplash going from the isolation of two people in the middle of nowhere with the occasional visitor at the Kiwi hut down the hill, to being at McMurdo with, 1,000 people at the peak of summer. But at the same time, everybody there is in Antarctica, and, a lot of people are working on things that are not penguin research, of course, or even not working on things that are research, but everyone's still in Antarctica and understands what it's about. The real culture shock is when you leave and go back to New Zealand at the end of.
Yes, definitely. I can imagine that must have been really something. Mm-hmm. Do you miss being in Antarctica?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I love it there.
Any plans to go back?
Well, not at present. I did my PhD on in the Northern Hemisphere, mm-hmm. here in the Salish Sea, in the Canadian portion of the Salish Sea where I live. Did it on gulls. So, I mostly work on gulls now, and finished a project on window collisions for bird window collisions as a conservation issue. But, of course, I'd love to go back if the opportunity arose. It's a beautiful place.
Another interesting aspect of this that I hadn't quite considered, but is there's a book that you talk about that David was fond of called In a Perfect Ocean by Daniel mm-hmm. Pauly and Jay McLean on the North Atlantic. Can you explain to us the concept of a perfect ocean and why the Ross Sea there where you were is like kind of the last bastion of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a long time since I read In a Perfect Ocean, which I actually read at Cape Royds when I was working there. So I don't have all the details of the book to hand, but, basically it's talking about the changes that have been wreaked by human activity, mostly industrial fishing in the North Atlantic Ocean, and how the baseline that we have today is so different than what that ocean would have been like hundreds of years ago, with its top predator communities intact and so on and so forth. And so that's something that ended up inspiring some of my PhD research, looking at historical changes in seabird communities or a seabird population rather. But also David has written a lot about, and well, he and I have written about a bit, the Antarctic, and that was, something that David talked about a lot when I was working there, about how the Atlantic is described in that book, In a Perfect Ocean, is contrasted to the Ross Sea, which, has been altered by human activity in the form of whaling and sealing and so on over a couple of hundred years, but is still, and this was something that was talked about in a very well-cited paper that came out by somebody called Ben Halpern sort of 15 years or so ago, that the Ross Sea is the most intact ocean on the face of the earth, the least affected by human activity. And I believe that Halpern and colleagues recently did a reanalysis of that and found it to be similar.
And another fascinating aspect to you being there was, and you write about it, it was your sense of sound, that when you would hear helicopters coming, for example, but the one that I really glommed onto was the sound of whales. Could you talk a little bit about, that experience?
Yes, it was remarkable to me how sound carried there. Helicopters, as you say, really distant helicopters would sound like they were coming into land and so on. But there were a couple of occasions where I was out late at night, again, night with quotation marks around it because it was, the sun was
still light,
but, you know, past bedtime anyway. And I'd either be down at the colony or sitting outside of our hut, and I'd hear some sound. And it's a bit disorienting too when you hear that, because, you know, in the real world, in the normal world here, you can generally hear, sort of tell how far something away is by the sound or where it's coming from and so on. But because the vistas are so open and because of the tricks that sound play there and so on, you really kind of can't tell where things, sounds are coming from or how far away they were. Anyway, the long and short of it was there were a couple of occasions where I realized that, I mean, I know the sound of whales. I actually had a job in my undergrad degree of driving a whale watching boat. And so I've heard whales blowing at sea a lot. So I recognized the sound, but it was a bit bewildering. And then eventually, like I said, I realized that there were these whales blowing and they sounded like they were really close and they were actually, you know, a couple of nautical miles offshore. So, you know, really interesting to see these killer whales way out amongst the ice floes and sounding like they were right down below the shoreline.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. One of the uncool things was, but I imagine mostly these people are okay, was when tourists would come, because there are restrictions. Not just anybody can go down into your study colony, right? There are boundaries. And yet sometimes there was one tourist who didn't get the message, evidently.
Yes, and definitely not to cast aspersions on people visiting there, because people are, by and large, really well behaved and very well briefed on, you know, needing to respect distances between themselves and animals and so on. But yeah, I do write about one particular individual who was a bit oblivious to the actual wildlife because of trying to see it all through the lens of his camera.
And isn't there like a boundary that's set up that, you know, you're not allowed to cross that? You know, you can as one of the researchers there, but, you know, if I was visiting just as a tourist, I would not be allowed there.
Yeah, there's not a physical boundary, but it's delineated on the map. Mm-hmm. And visitors should be aware.
And they're briefed.
Part of showing up there is you're told, okay, here, this is where the boundary is and don't go over that. Don't go into the penguin colony kind of thing.
I'd like to kind of finish up by just talking about the process of writing a book like this. It just amazes me the level of detail. You know, as I'm reading this book, I feel like I'm there with you, because you're describing the weather conditions, what the sky looked like, what the sea looked like, the ice, the colors, the sounds. Everything is so detailed. Could you just tell us a bit about the process of going from those journal notes to writing a book like this?
When I was offered the job, one of the things I said to a colleague about it was, you know, I could write a book about this, because obviously it's not something that many people get to do. And so I often or generally kept journals when I've traveled anyway. And so I just decided I'd be religious about it. And I wrote nearly every day when I was there. There'd be occasionally days when it was so busy that, you know, all I'd do would be eat and go to sleep and then get up again and didn't have time to write. But mostly I wrote every day. And so a lot of what's in the book is taken from my journals verbatim, or, you know, it's been edited somewhat for clarity and brevity and so on. But the immediacy comes from me writing about it when it happened. And then the writing the book was, you know, both transcribing it onto my laptop out of physical journal. Some of it was written onto my old laptop, and some of it was in a notebook.
And then finally, you wrote down the 10 things you'll miss at the end of the book before the epilogue. Could you just share those with us real quickly? Because I love those.
Sure. Thank you. I mean, really, there were more than 10 things, but this is what I whittled it down to. So a list of 10 things I'll miss. A warm sleeping bag in a tent that's filled with the light of a midnight sun. Penguin music. Cross-country skiing over the sea ice. The bottomless silence of a calm summer day. The fierce gaze of the skuas. Nodding to the ghosts of Shackleton's men at their hut. Coffee at the Wanigan with the Kiwis, the pale beauty of a monochromatic world, the transantarctic mountains taking up half the sky, and the solitude, the purest of solitudes.
Well, it's a wonderful book, Louise. I'm so glad you wrote it. I enjoyed it very much. And you close with some thoughts for the reader. I'd like you to leave us with your thoughts about that.
Sure. The last paragraph of the book reads, "I hope that you, the reader, can close this book and proceed with an open heart through the world in conversation with whatever it is that nature shares with you."
Well, Louise Blight, so enjoyed the book and so enjoyed having you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks again to our guest, Canadian conservation biologist Louise K. Blight from the University of Victoria's School of Environmental Studies. You can get her new book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, A Story of Penguins, People, and Place in Antarctica, at most major booksellers or order it from your local favorite bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.